I'm going to talk to you today about a very difficult issue. I've got a picture here that may help illustrate something. When you suffer a tremendous loss, it can be a lot of things, but lonely, debilitating, saddening, fearful, a lot of negative sorts of emotions. And there is a path ahead in Scripture. But there's a lot of times we try to get around it and go in some other direction, and we may not even see the mountains in the distance that we're trying to move forward to. But here's the reality. That path is painful. And I might rather try to avoid the pain and go around in some way. And if I do, I will remain shackled to the place where I started for the rest of my life. That's how it works. And I want to show this to you in Scripture. It's not a pleasant topic, yet at the same time, God is in the business of bringing us through this path with Him with us to the other side. The other side is another place where I'm now functioning in a healthy way again. The loss isn't forgotten. Time doesn't, in fact, heal all wounds. God does. The loss remains with us, and life may not be the same thereafter. But there's a way to deal with it. And I want you to have that in mind. You're not going to walk that path in a day, depending on the size of the loss. That path may take months or years before you're at the other side, and you can now function even with the loss, but you're now in a healthy way. And we're going to look at this very closely, and I want to show you what the Scripture says about it. There's four fundamental questions when you're going through this valley. First of all, is God there? Second, does He care about my personal situation? Third, is He able to do anything about it? And fourth, will He in fact do something about it? And I want to read to you Psalm 34:18. The Lord is nigh unto them that are of a broken heart. And say this such as be of a contrite spirit. The Lord is nigh unto them that are of a broken heart. Here's Psalm 147, verse 3. He healeth the broken in heart, and He bindeth up their wounds. Jesus would deal with this in Matthew 5. You know the verse. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be what? Comforted. The comfort's the God part of the equation. The mourning is our part. We have to define a few terms. I think it'll help us to define some words, because you can spend weeks or months weeping bitterly and believe that you are somehow progressing towards those mountains in the distance and you haven't moved an inch because you haven't wept about the loss. You've wept about the circumstances or something else. It's very easy to mistake the grave emotions we have with actually mourning the loss. And so we need some definitions. First of all, loss. I've defined a loss here, and it's in the notes that were in this morning's bulletin on the back. The separation from a removal of something meaningful to an individual. Now, I'm going to put some flesh on this in a moment. Losses aren't just loss of people who have passed on. There's a lot of losses we need to contemplate that we can grieve. But it's the separation. I'm assuming permanent. Sometimes we have temporary losses. Sometimes you think it's gone forever, and then it comes back. A week or so back, some friends on Facebook posted they bought a brand new car, and it was gone the next morning. And miraculously, a few weeks later, they get it back. But material possessions, people never come back, though. And so different kinds of losses, but I'm assuming generally a permanent separation. Grief or sorrow, I'm talking about the noun, grief or sorrow. You don't usually find the word grief so much in the King James, but you find sorrow. And it's the cluster of emotions associated with our contemplation of the loss and a future without that which we've lost. There's a whole lot of emotions that flood a person as they lose something, and depending on what is lost, different emotions come. One is loneliness. We'll see a lot of that today in the passage, the key passage. Fear. Great sadness, all these things. It's all these emotions at once. It's like emotional overload, and somehow we have to struggle through that. But there's to grieve or to mourn as a verb, as a process, as something we can do. It's the process whereby grief is expressed, and over time the person separates from the loss. Now, that's a very technical type of definition, but here's what I'm telling you. You can become identified with your loss and never move forward. Your world is like you're looking at yourself and your circumstances through a straw, and all you see is the loss. You have to get separated from that at some point. It's not forgotten. It's merely not what's consuming you. And so that's a process, and that's this grieving process. It's not the same as weeping, although one will often weep as part of this. There's a lot of things that are not the same as this process. This process takes time, and this process hurts. And we'll put some meat on it. Everyone has grief, by the way, but mourning is a choice. It's a choice. And may I say, our culture's not set up for it. Someone passes away, we have a day off for a funeral, and the next day we're back at the office. You know, you have to set aside time to mourn, particularly the loss of a person. That notion that we'll just be over it in a day or a week, you know, the church will call you a lot, people from church, for a couple of weeks, but 6 months later people assume you're over it and you're not. And all of a sudden you feel alone in the universe. That's the reality. And so these things, this mourning is a choice, and it's going to take some time. Let me talk about different kinds of losses. I've categorized four different kinds. It'll help us to think through this, because I don't want you to leave with the impression that this is only about when someone has passed away. I think that's perhaps the most serious sort of loss, but there's a lot of other losses that are near to it. And it helps us, because we have to realize that some losses other than somebody passing away require us to grieve. And if we don't, then we will not function in a healthy manner again. Different kinds of losses. First of all, a physical or an objective loss. For example, the loss of a loved one, that's an obvious one, but what about the loss of a job? The loss of your home because it caught fire, and now everything, all the family photos, every possession except the shirt on your back is gone. You can mourn that. There's a loss associated with it. The house where your children grew up, where all those memories attached to it. So things beyond just a passing of a person. Any valuable material possession. My favorite John Wayne movie is a movie called The Quiet Man. It had an actress named Maureen O'Hara that passed away in 2015. But she played a character, Kate Danaher. And when John Wayne's character, Sean Thornton, marries her, everything just has problems because her mean brother will not provide the dowry. It was essentially a collection of furniture that had been passed down through the family, and when she got married, it was to be hers. And sort of as all those years looking forward to one day meeting the right man and getting married, her dreams kind of become identified with some old furniture. And when that man won't give it to her, she goes into a lot of depression and anger. And I'm just saying that by way of illustrating that sometimes material stuff can cause a tremendous loss, not because it has intrinsic economic value, but somehow it's identified, perhaps with, in her case, hopes and dreams. A picture in her mind of what the future would be and how that would be arranged and the home her and her husband would make together. Material possessions can be a part of this. Your health. Physically moving away, particularly children of a certain age moving away and loss of all the friendships that they had in high school or something is important. You know, for some people, and I mention this because it's important that we not rank people's losses and how we try to help them. Some people will mourn bitterly over the loss of a pet. Others, maybe not. I've noticed especially those who don't have children will seem to often place a very high value on their pets. And I've seen tremendous emotional toil when the pet has passed. And one person will say, well, that's just not a big deal. It's a big deal to them. So what are you going to do to be there? What are you going to do to help? And grading them and saying how they should respond is not, of course, the proper way to do it. A loss of financial security, a loss of a body part. One has to go forward with a hand or a foot missing. These are things that are real physical, concrete losses. I'll mention a couple of others. This one hit home to me, and I thought not to mention it, but it needs saying. You can mourn the loss of a church. Some of us had a church called Berean Baptist Church. And for myself, I feel I was robbed of that. It meant a lot. And so there was a mourning process associated with that, but it was helpful for me to realize that it is appropriate to mourn that loss. Years ago, I had a mentor who's now deceased. He meant a lot. He really is the person that first really introduced me to the Word of God and the serious study of the Word of God. He seemed to have all the answers, a very capable teacher, a pastor, someone with a radio show, just a lot of things going on. And I would get on his church's website and download his sermons each week. And when I got on there one time, and the church had a public message on the home page of that website that said he had been fired because it was discovered he had had an affair for the last 10 years with a member of the church. It's an odd sort of loss. It's not so much a concrete loss as an abstract loss. But it affected me in a lot of ways. And it can, to see a role model fail in some way, especially if you've attached a lot of value to their influence on you. And you can have that kind of loss. You know, a child is lost, and I say this to, you know, losses are multifaceted. It's not just the absence of the child going forward. There was that birthday party the parents were planning, the high school graduation in the near future, their plans for college, how they had visited some colleges and looked at them. All these things start impacting you as you start contemplating the gravity of the loss, the dream of one day walking that young girl down the aisle and giving her away in marriage, the family game nights that you had, the special dad and daughter times. See, there's a whole lot more than just the physical absence of the person. And you don't contemplate these all in a moment in time. You contemplate these over a course of time. And we're going to see that. Time's very important. Time doesn't heal all wounds, but it takes a great deal of time for wounds to heal. And so all these things come to bear. There's abstract or subjective losses, the loss of hopes and dreams. When you're a young man with a football scholarship and you have a motorcycle accident that summer that tears your leg up and they immediately yank the scholarship. Okay, that's something sort of abstract, but you've got a real loss there, a future you envision that's built around that. Dreams, your role, your loss of reputation, or an aspect of your self-image, loss of confidence. You get robbed at a store at gunpoint, and you never really feel safe after that. There's a lot of things you can lose that are sort of intangible. A 50-year-old businessman is told that the company is downsizing. He's not going to have a job anymore. There's the loss of the job, but there's also sort of the identity. This is particularly with men. We sort of identify with our work. It's very much part of who we are. That's been ripped away. In your mind, you were retiring there in 7 years or whatever, and it's in your mind. Your sense of purpose and ambition maybe is ripped away in that moment. A young lady's fiance breaks off the engagement, and it's not just the relationship's gone, but her role as an engaged person. You know, it's all going to change now. When you read the Song of Solomon, chapter 5, the young lady in that song, Shulamit, struggles with the fact that she'll be married soon, and that phase of life will be over in which she was a young, unmarried lady. And she struggles with that. She wants to be married. She looks forward to it. Yet there's a phase of life gone. You want your child to go off to college and do well, and yet in a moment, the house will be empty. Everything's different. No more t-ball games to go to. No more music recitals. They all change, and there's a loss there, and it's appropriate to recognize that and mourn it. There's also what we might call imagined losses. These are harder to deal with, but the mere fear of what you will lose can have all those same emotions attached to it, and people can struggle, especially insecure people will struggle with, will this relationship be lost? And it will take hold of them in a way. And it's hard to deal with. And then there's the threatened loss. You hear that the jobs are going to be cut back. You don't know if you're one of the ones getting cut. And all kinds of emotions can go through as you start thinking about how you'll deal with paying for the kid in college and the house note and all these things. So lots of different kinds of losses. Let's talk about the responsibility then to mourn, and we'll start looking at this process. When you have a physical wound, you have a responsibility to clean the wound. You have to put bandages on it, put the proper medication, perhaps get a tetanus shot. That's your responsibility. God has designed your body to heal itself. But if you do nothing and you just leave the wound open, like they say in the old days, you're going to get gangrene, it's not going to heal itself. But if you do your part, God has designed your body to heal itself. Emotional wounds work much like that. You're going to have a part to do. That's what we call the mourning process, the grieving process. God does the healing. But if I refuse to mourn in a way that God has set forth in Scripture, the healing isn't going to necessarily be there. And so it works much like a physical wound. We have to mourn losses so God can bring healing. But one thing about Christians, we mourn with hope. We know that. There's a good verse in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 13, where Paul writes, "But I would not have you be ignorant, brethren, concerning them which were asleep." That's a euphemism for those who have passed away. People within the church in Thessalonica have passed away. He says, "I don't want you to be ignorant about those people, that you sorrow not." That's grieve. That's the New Testament word in the King James language for grieving. He says, you know what, you're going to sorrow, but you're not going to sorrow in quite the same way. Why? He says, even as others which have no hope. See, our hope is one aspect of Christian grieving that's different from anyone else. The hope is a great family reunion. I don't know when it'll happen, but the reality of it's happening is certain because Jesus said, if I go away to prepare a place for you, this is John 14, I will come back, return, and I'm going to take you there. You see, there's a time, a future resurrection that the Apostle Paul would talk about in 1 Corinthians 15. And those who have been lost, who knew Jesus Christ, will be there. And so that gives us a hope for those who have passed. We sorrow because they are gone and all the effects that has on our life, yet we can have some hope that I will be reunited with them. Lots of people, I think, aren't aware of this. Even Christians sometimes. I can remember someone in my class years ago struggling over the loss of a very small child to leukemia. Very sad. No words will take that away. But a family reunion, a time to see that child again, to be reunited, to realize she's always been safely in the arms of Jesus Christ, that's a big thing. So we have to mourn with hope. Let me mention some people in the Bible who suffer great losses and mourned. I just want you to see that mourning is a part of life, and it's something that is going to be there. For example, Abraham, when his wife died, and we read this in Genesis 23:2, it says, "And Sarah died in Kirjath Arba, the same as Hebron in the land of Canaan." And hear this, "Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her." What you'll find in these Old Testament passages is they set aside a time to mourn, because if you don't, it probably won't get done. And our culture is just not set up for it. We're so busy that it's very difficult to set aside time and do this. Isaac, Naomi, David, others, even Jesus himself, it seems, mourned the loss of John the Baptist. Jacob, in Genesis 37, verse 34, it says, "Jacob rent his clothes and put sackcloth upon his loins and mourned for his son many days." He believed he had lost Joseph. You know the story. That's not a real loss in the sense that he wasn't actually dead, right? Yet it had all the emotions because he believed that his son was dead. Verse 35 said, "And all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him. But he refused to be comforted, and he said, 'For I will go down into the grave unto my son, mourning.'" Is that what we'd like to do? No, that's reality. He felt he would mourn until the day he died. He says, "Thus his father wept for him," in Genesis 42, verse 38, "And he said, 'My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is left alone. If mischief befall him by the way in which ye go, then shall ye bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to the grave.'" Remember when the rest of the boys went back to Egypt to try to get food, he didn't want one of them to go because he was worried about losing another one and sort of cumulatively compounding his sorrow. You know, Hannah grieved because she was barren. There's lots of things that can cause this grieving. 1 Samuel 1:7, and As he did so year by year, when she went up to the house of the Lord, so she provoked her. Therefore she wept and did not eat. Then said Elkanah, her husband, to her, Hannah, why weepest thou? Why eatest thou not? And why is thy heart grieved? Am I not better to thee than 10 sons? Yeah, he didn't get it. But you know, she grieved because of her desire for a son, and she prayed for a son, and for a long time there was no son. One more I'll mention is Joseph, just because it's the most lengthy description we have of an actual mourning process outside the book of Lamentations. And it's Genesis 50, verse 1. Joseph fell upon his father's face and wept upon him and kissed him. This is when Jacob had passed. Genesis 50, verse 2, and Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. That was the practice in Egypt, to do the embalming. And the physicians embalmed Israel. Israel is Jacob. 40 days were fulfilled for him, for so are fulfilled the days of those which were embalmed. And the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. Huh? That's 70 days of mourning set aside. And you're going to see in a moment, straight from the Bible, why it is the setting aside of time is so important, and realize the reality that one can't necessarily take 70 days off of work. You have to set aside time to mourn the loss of a loved one, and that's what Joseph did. In Genesis 50, verse 7, Joseph went up to bury his father. Remember, he wanted to bring him back. Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, and all the house of Joseph, and his brethren, and his father's house, only their little ones, and their flocks, and their herds, they left in the land of Goshen. So he's left Egypt, Goshen's in Egypt, to come and bury his father. Verse 10 says, and they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond Jordan, and there they mourned with a great, very sore lamentation, and he made a mourning for his father 7 days. So lots of mourning, lots of purposeful mourning. Let me talk about the first step of this process, and I'm going to finish the rest of it next week, but and it's important to understand. What I'll talk about today in what follows is, I think, the most important thing, and yet it's just the beginning. It's the first step, and it's the first step is the painful part. And that is this notion of contemplating the loss. Bear in mind a few things. We grieve losses, not events. You can get tied up in the events. Okay, I've known of folks who they've lost a child because they backed a car over them. You can get tangled up and the guilt of that, and have a lot of emotional turmoil, but not get to the grieving part over the loss itself. And if you keep reliving that event and how it should have been better and how you shouldn't have left the child in the hot car and all those things, you're not going to get to a point of being healthy again. And so we grieve losses, not events. We're not trying to relive the tragedy. A drunk driver took our child, or whatever happened to you. Those things can consume you. Anger, hate towards those you believe have caused the loss can consume you. That anger's a natural thing, but you have to get to grieving. People tend to think there's an expiration date on grieving, a point of time at which you're supposed to just be over it. We don't get to stand over others and tell them they should be over it. You should not tell somebody else they've had long enough to grieve. Neither should they tell you that. You know, we're not in control of what triggers the memory. That's the reason it's a process. Things can happen many years later. An event, a word, a song brings it back. A young man I knew in high school, because his girlfriend broke up with him, he shot himself and died. There was a song played at the funeral, a very popular song at the time, and it was popular enough that you'll still hear it from time to time on the radio. When I hear it, there I am back in 1988, thinking about a young man up there in a box that shot himself. Things trigger it back. I don't control that. I can't help it. The moment I hear that song, I go back in time. So what are we going to do? See, we have to have this grieving process where we've sort of dealt with this so that I can have the emotions again, because I can't control that, but I can manage them and be able to move forward in a healthy way. We don't control what triggers that memory, but what we do with it matters. It's necessary for us, and this is the first step, it's necessary for us to have contemplated and assimilated the loss. It's not a one-time event. I'm going to deal with Lamentations 1. If you have your Bibles, turn to Lamentations. I'm going to give you a little bit of technical background to understand what I'm saying and how I get this from this book. You suffer a big loss, you may have to live in Lamentations 1 for weeks or months. This book is written with a very discreet purpose in mind, and I wouldn't want you to walk away thinking, well, okay, there's five chapters to Lamentations, five steps, and I'm through this. There's a long journey through Lamentations 1, and it gets repeated over and over before you get to 2, before you get to the great hope of chapter 3, before you get to the prayer in chapter 5 of handing it over to God. So there's a lot here. Some technical stuff that's actually directly pertinent to how you interpret Lamentations 1. First of all, when you look at Lamentations 1, it has 22 verses. And when you look at Lamentations 2, it has 22 verses. When you look at Lamentations 3, it has 66 verses. That's 22 times 3. I have a math degree, but it doesn't take much to figure that. There's a method to the madness. Lamentations 4, 22 verses again. Lamentations 5, 22 verses. God doesn't do things coincidentally. There's 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. The first letter is Aleph, Bet, Gimel. It ends with Tav, the last letter, the 22nd letter of the alphabet. What the Jewish writers would sometimes do is start every line of a poem, and this is a sort of poem here in Lamentations. Each chapter is a separate poem. There's five poems. They would start with a different letter. It would be like me starting with A, then the second line of the poem would start with a B, and then the third line with a C, and all the way through Z, 26 letters. I'd have 26 verses. But here, there's 22 letters in the alphabet, so 22 verses. And you can't see it in the King James translation, but each Hebrew line of poetry starts with a different letter, except there's three lines for each stanza. You know, a poem is written in stanzas. There's three lines for each stanza in chapter 1 and in chapter 2. But in chapter 3, it's tripled. And what happens is there's three lines that start with an A, three lines that start with a B, three with a C, and you end up with 66 verses. It's much longer. But if you look at chapter 4, it's shorter again, and then chapter 5 is the shortest of all. Chapter 5 only has one line for each verse of poetry, and chapter 5 doesn't do the A, B, C, D, E through Z. It doesn't. Only chapters 1 through 4 do. Chapter 5 is sort of structured the same way, but it's a little more erratic, and it's a prayer. And you say, well, why does all that technical stuff matter? We're going to focus on chapter 1. The idea of chapter 1 is I need to fully contemplate the loss. The idea of healing from the emotional wounds begins with me having contemplated the loss from A to Z, the whole thing in its totality. You see, I can't minimize the loss. I can't say, well, what happened to me isn't as bad as what happened to the guy down the street. I need to deal with the loss, the facts of the loss, the cause of it. If I backed over my child, the drunk driver took them. I need to deal with the implications for the future. It's the A to the Z. It's the idea of fullness. And it may have helped them memorize this lament because it was publicly spoken, but they could work through from Aleph to Tav and sort of start over because you're going to spend some time there as you continue to contemplate the actuality of the loss over and over. And that's the nature of why it's written in this way, why there are the chapters divided this way, and why there's 22 verses. Think of it as sort of a completion of the process. And it ends in chapter 5. But it's not the idea of step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I'm done. You're going to spend a lot of time in step 1. And you may get to step 3, the third chapter, and end up backing up again. It's just not going to work easily. But it does come to an end. And after chapter 3, which has a great crescendo, we'll see next week, because chapter 3 is where you read the one verse or two verses that we actually hear from Lamentations. God's mercies are new every morning. Then chapter 4 starts to sort of go on a decrease, start to pull away from it as a healing is taking place. And in chapter 5, the prayers given to God, the losses handed to God. But in chapter 1, you don't feel like handing anything over. You're mad at God. In chapter 5, you're handing it to Him. See, there's movement, but it's not just going to be linear. It's just backing up and then pressing forward. So let's, with that thought in mind, look at chapter 1 of Lamentations. I'm not going to read the whole passage, but I do want to show you a few verses to get the sense of it. What I'm trying to suggest to you about chapter 1, about fully contemplating the losses, I've listed in the notes the facts of the loss, the actual facts of the loss, and I'll show you that in verses 1 through 4, the focus of the loss. In other words, you've lost a person, or you've lost a job, right? If you've lost some material possession, that's the focus of the loss, but there's other things attached to that, sort of secondary losses with it. But the focus of the loss, we have to see that. The value, the cost of the loss, I've listed on the notes, because we have to contemplate the cost to us, the means of the loss. Now, sometimes there are no means. Sometimes someone has passed by natural causes. In Lamentations 1, the mourning there will be something God brought about, the harm. That is to say, the background historically for Lamentations is because of disobedience, God brought the Babylonians in to take the city of Jerusalem in 587 BC, and the destruction was total. It was just tremendous. There hasn't been anything like it until more modern warfare, and it was so total, and they had to contemplate the reality that it's their fault that it happened, that their own conduct was part of the means of the loss. Left the gun on the counter, loaded. Child played with it. How do you deal with that? You have to contemplate the means of the loss. There's nothing pleasant about it, yet it can become a shackle. The means of the loss are dealt with here. Listen to verses 1 through 4. There's a beauty to what's here, despite the pain. How doth the city sit solitary that was full of people? How has she become as a widow? She that was great among the nations and princess among the provinces, how has she become tributary? This is personifying the city of Jerusalem. And in the first, really, verses, I guess about 1 through 11, it's in the third person. It's from the observation standpoint of what's become of the widow, the city, Jerusalem. And then what follows becomes more first person as the widow speaks, and it becomes more personal. And you get to chapter 2, it becomes more personal than that. But it's loneliness. How solitary is the city? When you think of one of the major emotions that comes with tremendous loss, it's loneliness. And you'll see it throughout here. In verse 2, it says there's none to comfort. It says the same thing in verse 9, verse 16, verse 17, verse 21. Chapter 1, verse 3 says she finds no rest. If there's a theme in this chapter, it's the loneliness associated with the pain. She'll contemplate the losses, but she's flooded with loneliness. Look at what's actually been lost. Verse 2 says, she weeps sore in the night. There's the emotional outpouring. I'm not the one to say you have to weep to go through a loss, and you probably shouldn't tell me I have to. It's probably a good thing. A lot of us, particularly men, are trying to gear toward not showing our emotions, yet the emotions are inside. Everybody's emotional. God made you that way. To let them come out during this time is healthy. She weeps sore in the night, and her tears are on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she hath none to comfort her. There's the loneliness. Her lovers are her allies that she depended on instead of God. But the point is, they're gone. The allies are gone. She's contemplating her losses. We have to contemplate ours when we go through a tremendous loss. What's actually gone? All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. Loss of those relationships. Now, this is personified as if they're just friends, but it's neighboring countries and so forth. But again, we're making application. What have we lost when someone's gone? They have become her enemies. Judah has gone into captivity. Because of affliction. And the affliction is what God has done to them because of their sin. And Judah is now not just the place, but it's people. The country doesn't move, but the people have gone. And because of great servitude, she dwelleth among the heathen. She findeth no rest. This is the scattering of God's people. The city has been left empty. That's why the city is barren and lonely. The people have been taken away into bondage under Nebuchadnezzar. All her persecutors overtook her between the straits. There's a loss of a resting place in this verse. It says she can find no rest. A family member of mine lost her husband a few years ago, and he was very young, unexpected. One of the things that my uncle told me, and I was at the funeral, he said, "I haven't slept in 12 days. This is a reality. She can find no rest. She can find no rest. The emotions wouldn't, he viewed this young man, his son-in-law, as a son. It would not allow any rest. Verse 4 says, the ways of Zion, the ways means the roads. See, when you're reading the Psalms and you get to the Hallel, Psalm 111, 112, 113, these songs in the Bible would be sung as a journey to Jerusalem to do the feast and to celebrate God and to worship, but no one takes those roads anymore. They're empty. Everybody's gone. And so the roads cry out in sorrow. That's what verse 4 says. The roads, the ways of Zion mourn. Even the roads mourn, as it were. This is poetic, but you get the idea. Everything is gone. Everything's gone. None come to the solemn feast. Her gates are desolate. Her priests sigh. Her virgins, that's the young ladies, are afflicted, and she's in bitterness. And you can go on, but she contemplates the facts of the loss. The facts of the loss. And I'm saying, I might try to avoid the pain because it hurts to contemplate the facts of the loss. But if I avoid the pain, then maybe I could cheer myself up, or someone can cheer me up, or I could drink enough booze to forget about it. And God says, you're going to have to grapple with, you're going to have to contemplate the facts of the loss in its detail, in its painful detail. And that's what Lamentations 1 is all about, dealing with that. The focus of the loss is in verse 18. It's the lost lives. Verse 18 says, the Lord is righteous, for I have rebelled against his commandment. Hear, I pray you, all people, and behold my sorrow. And listen to what the city says. This is the city of Jerusalem speaking as a person. The city says, my virgins, my young ladies, and my young men are gone into captivity. It's the loss of the people. There's those that are dead and those that are gone. And the city mourns their loss. And that's what we do. We mourn losses. And the focus of the loss is the loss of these young people. That whole generation has been removed. And then there's all these subsidiary losses. No one comes to the feast anymore. No one worships in the temple anymore. There's famine in the streets. All those things. But those are secondary. And yet the city contemplates all of it and puts it all on the table. Nothing's held back. It's just genuine. And you'll see as you read the chapter, there's some angst towards God. God, how could you let this happen to us? All those things pour out, but that's how people feel. You feel lonely. You feel that maybe God wasn't there. How could this happen? How is this fair? It's all here in this chapter. There's the value of the loss. For example, in verse 6, from the daughter of Zion, all her beauty is departed. Her princes are become like harts. That's like young deer animals that find no pasture. What happens when the deer find no pasture? They starve. And there's deprivation in the streets. What little's left in Jerusalem is dying in the street, and it's even become to the point, as you'll read later, of cannibalism. It's as bad times can get. And you say, so what's the cost? There's a tremendous cost associated with this loss, and she has to contemplate it. They're gone without strength from the pursuer. Verse 10, the adversary has spread out his hand upon all her pleasant things. It uses rape imagery. It's not pretty. But what got lost? Remember, it's the city that's mourning. For she has seen that the heathen, the Gentiles, entered her sanctuary, God's temple. That great temple that Solomon had built by God's direction, that had the gold and everything, the temple has been destroyed. And that's what she's talking about. The cost of this loss included the loss of the temple, something that no other city has ever had in history. It says that they entered into her sanctuary, whom thou didst command that they should not enter into thy congregation. Gentiles weren't allowed there. But when Nebuchadnezzar came in, he didn't follow the rules. He went in there and took everything out. You start reading the book of Daniel, you'll find that they decided to pull that stuff out of the attic a few years later, and God took a hand to them in the book of Daniel. But what a tremendous cost here. The effect of the loss, how do we get here? One doesn't always cause their loss or have someone else cause it. Sin, the ravages of time, will take people from us if nothing else happens. And yet here, they must contemplate how they got here. Verse 12 says, "Is it nothing to you, all you that pass by? The city sees the people traveling by the king's highway and so forth, and they pass by and they see the city and they shake their hands at it. Where was her God? Where was her God?" Look at what it says. "Behold and see if there be any sorrow like unto my sorrow." That moment she feels like there's never been tragedy like hers. That's a real feeling I think we have with the worst losses, as if we're the first and the only it's happened to. And she feels that. She says, "Which is done unto me, wherewith the Lord hath afflicted me in the day of this fierce anger. From above hath he sent fire into my bones, and it prevaileth against them." There's an emotional pain, but there's a physical pain associated with it, the fire in the bones. When I have had something happen that was a tremendous loss, I was sick. I had a lot of tightness in my chest and my stomach, and just for a great amount of time, that happens. I don't want to eat anything, not for several days. And really, you know, I'm just saying that's reality. Fire in her bones. "He has spread a net for my feet." She views God almost like the enemy. And she'll say that later. "He's the one that did this. He has spread a net for my feet. He hath turned me back. He hath made me desolate and faint all the day." But she has to contemplate how she got there. Well, there's also the feelings and emotions from the loss, and you see that poured out really throughout this chapter. What I'm telling you is it's really simple, and yet in a way it's profound that it's here. You have to fully contemplate the loss and sort of put it on the table and live with it and think on it in order to have healing. And in the rest of Lamentations, we'll look at some more of that next week, but that begins the process. And to do something like to medicate it or to go into denial about what's happened or someone takes the life of someone you love and you're angry about it, anger gives me a sense of control, and it keeps me distracted from what I can't control, and that is the loss. And so there becomes a point when that's unhealthy. There's lots of ways we try to avoid Lamentations 1, but we've got to go there. Nostalgia. I'll leave their room how it was set up, and I'll never touch a single part of it because it would be a betrayal of my memories of that person. And yet, at the same time, I can allow that to become almost a fantasy, as if one day I'll open the door and they'll be there. But they won't. And I've got to go through Lamentations 1, and it's going to hurt to think about it. I'm going to leave you with a practical exercise. And this is something that professional counselors do, and I think it's actually valuable. And that's why I just want to mention it quickly, and we'll bring it to a close. They call it a grief inventory. This is when you take down a piece of paper when you're in the midst of this loss, or at some point when you're ready to try to function again, and you write down the facts of the loss. You make a physical list of what is gone and how it's cost me and what the focus of that loss is and how it's affecting my life. And you take that out and you set aside a time every day and you take it out and you read and you think through this. And maybe you'll think of something else because you're going through life and you're realizing here's another thing that's gone. And you add it and you think through it. And you do that for about 60 days at least and see where you are at that point. The Lamentations 1 is A through Z, but it's not one time. And it's something that would be repeated. And counselors will have you write this down. And I think it's healthy. And so you say, well, that's hurtful. I don't want to think about it every day. You have to. That's the way to the mountains on the other side of the valley, is to have contemplated it in detail. This is your grief work. You know, you have to grieve responsibly, if that makes sense. And what I mean is, you can grieve irresponsibly. You can get lost in the pain. You can get lost in feeling sorry for yourself, blaming others because they're the ones that are at fault for the loss. And yet, you're not really grieving the loss yet. At the same time, you can have responsibility. You deal with what you've got to deal with. You've got to call the funeral home, and you've got to deal with this, and you've got to make sure there's food when all the people come over the house. And you're doing all that stuff like Martha, and yet you haven't actually dealt with the loss itself. So you can have responsibility without grieving. You've got to have grief with responsibility. Grief with responsibility. And that's what I'm talking about maybe even listing it out, if that helps, and going through it in that way so that we can continue to function. And we all this starts with contemplating the loss in a very deliberate fashion. Okay? So I'm going to bring it to a close there, and then next time we'll talk about how to move it forward from contemplation of the loss to hope.